that bother, how do doctors feel about that?
I'm sure there's, you know, you can ask me, I can tell you how I feel about it. Doctors in general, I would say that we're opposed to it, because it complicates our lives a bit. It makes medicine more expensive because they don't advertise generic drugs. They only advertise medications that are still on patent, that is more expensive than usual, and that still costs, you know, that will cost people money. And there's nothing more frustrating than to have a patient come in already wanting a particular medication or a particular drug and convinced that they want it. So now you're stuck because you don't have the time to sit down and have an hour long, you know, we're not going to give them a lecture and a presentation about what they might have or not have or whatever. And it becomes much easier to just say, all right, you know, here's your prescription, go, you know, if your insurance covers it, and I let them go. The same thing about the internet in general, is that we've got people coming in that, you know, you got belly pain, your knee hurts, you got a rash, you Google on the internet, you know, belly pain, and you come up with a long list of diagnoses, and you read about them, and then you figure out, well, that must be the one I got, you know, and then you're convinced you have it. And it just makes medication and just treatment a lot more difficult than it used to be. It's good to have an educated public. It's good, but there's also so much misinformation that's out there. A huge amount of misinformation. But it used to be, you know, you went to your physician, that was your source of information about whatever it was that was wrong with you. Now you have a lot more information, and it kind of forces physicians a little bit to keep up a little more up to date, a little more on their toes about this. So I think some of it is good.
Do you think the Mayo Clinic puts out a good webpage?
Yes. The Mayo, Johns Hopkins puts out a very good publication on for health issues. The Mayo Clinic has an excellent one. University of Washington has a publication. You really can't go wrong using that as a source of information. And there are very good there are some very good websites. WebMD is a good website. You can get onto the National Library of Medicine and get information that can get you into a number of websites that have very accurate, up to date information.
Speaking of Mayo Clinic, it seems like I've read that they are one of the most efficient hospital or healthcare centers in the nation.
Cost-wise.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Have you heard that, or what do they do
They are very efficient, and they get people through very quickly. They do something else, though, that's not so good. If you live near the Mayo Clinic, it's fantastic, because they will take really good care in a highly efficient, highly systematic way, and you can rely on it, you're going to get good medical care. If you're sent in, you know, Mayo Clinic has this great reputation, so does the Cleveland Clinic, and, you know, there are a number of places like that have wonderful reputations, worldwide reputations. So you get sent in from a distance, the Mayo Clinic. So let's just say Dr. Hall in Corvallis, Oregon, and he's got a problem case, he's been working on this patient, just not getting better. Finally, a patient says, Doc, why don't you send me to Mayo Clinic, because I know they're going to do a good job. And so I say, okay, so we call them up, and we send them with all the records to the Mayo Clinic. The Mayo Clinic knows that they're going to have that patient for 2 days, 3 days, maybe a week. They're going to have to find what's wrong with that patient, because the last thing that they want to do is to do a bunch of tests and then say, God, we're no smarter than Dr. Hall. We still don't know what it is. We'll go back and maybe it will become clear in 6 months from now. Well, it becomes clear in 6 months. The patient comes back and says, we went to the Mayo Clinic. They couldn't figure out what kind of clowns are they at the Mayo Clinic. So the Mayo Clinic does everything in situations like that, because they feel they only have this brief period of time. Whereas in a smaller community with good physicians, they can say, okay, you know, we know you're not dying, we're not quite sure, but let's see, you know, come back in a month, we're going to repeat some tests and see where we're going. So that's a little different approach. All right. Thank you all for coming late on a Wednesday evening. Does anybody know whether this is a golden mantled ground squirrel or a chipmunk?
Golden mantled ground squirrel.
Is it?
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's what I thought. Isn't that what I thought earlier?
Yes,
I'm not just making, my wife thinks, well, you know, Clint does that all the time. All right, is this Holden Village or New York City? Can anybody help me? Yes, thank you. All right, we're going to talk about medical ethics. Some of you have seen this before. This is one of the problems with American medicine. Disclosures. We're talking about ethics. I am not an ethicist. I am not a philosopher, although I will pretend as we go along that I know something about ethics and I know something about philosophy. I do know something about medicine, and I've practiced medicine for quite a while. So what we're going to look at is look at it from the perspective of someone who has been practicing medicine. I am chairman of the Ethics Committee and have been for quite a while at the Regional Medical Center, and I've been coming up here to Holden Village off and on over the past 12, 13 years participating in discussions like this. All right, we're going to start with a real case. And imagine that you're all Dr. Halls. You're out there. This lady comes into your office. She's 88 years old. She's a widow. She lives in a retirement home, but really getting along pretty well. She's a little frail. Doesn't even use a walker or a wheelchair. She comes in with her daughter who lives in the town. The daughter states that mom is mentally competent, doesn't seem to be depressed. She gets along. She has some friends. She has this permanent pacemaker that she's had for the past 10 years. The pacemaker we check and periodically make sure it's working fine. And she says to you, please turn off this pacemaker and let me die. I'm 88 years old. I've lived a good life. I just don't feel like living anymore. You know, not that she's in great pain, not that she has a terminal illness, other than just being old, but not that she's necessarily going to die immediately. We don't have to go in with a big knife or anything. We can do this electronically, just put a little probe over the chest. It's like a garage door opener, you know, you program it. We could turn it off, and she might just drop dead right there in the office. Goodbye, Mrs. AJ. All right. What are we going to do? How are we going to decide? Is there a right answer? And if so, what is it? So who wants to turn off the pacemaker? Raise your hand. Come on now, this is a real case. This is not something, you would turn off the pacemaker, you would turn off, and you have good lawyers, right? Okay, so we've got a few people would say they would turn off the pacemaker. The majority say no. We definitely not turn off the pacemaker.
Or you like you would defer to the daughter.
Yeah, okay, the daughter says, look, mom is an independent lady, you know, I mean, I can't make her do anything that I want her to do. She lives her own life, she's always been that way. Ask the geologist.
What I think I remember in watching, like, doctor shows on TV.
Well, let's not ask the geologist.
which are all true, is there's that thing that all doctors talk about, and isn't there somewhere in there something about first do no harm? And it would seem to me that turning off the pacemaker would be harmful.
Right, but she ought to be able to decide that she wants treatment or doesn't want. She has a right to refuse treatment.
What I think that thing says on the TV shows is first do no harm. It doesn't say except in these circumstances.
But what is harm there?
That's right. Good question. Okay, so it's not really straightforward. It might be. I mean, some people may feel.
But she could live too.
Yeah. Well, let's just think about it anyway. We're going to talk about ethics, and we're going to see whether things become clearer as we go along, or get more money. Okay, how do physicians approach difficult clinical decisions? That's a difficult clinical decision. It's not technically difficult. It's just emotionally difficult. Philosophy, science, we got up there. Science, aesthetics, and ethics. What is the nature of the universe? What is true? We've been hearing about geology. What, you know, science, what makes up this universe? What is it? Aesthetics, what is beauty? And Trish has been teaching art, and we hear music. And so that's the aesthetics part of it. This is really Aristotle's approach, and ethics, what is good. And so that's what we're going to kind of concentrate on this evening. Ethics and ethical behavior, what is it, how do we recognize it, how do we know it? Okay, so ethics, system, theory of moral values. It's of right behavior. It's knowing what's good, living that. It's acting that good. It's doing good. And so that's fine, Dr. Hall, but what does that mean? I mean, what does it mean with the AJ lady? Is it good to do what she wants? Or is it good to kill her? Is it good to just let things go on the way they are, because that's the way they are and it's easier to do it that way? So historically, what has been the ethical things? Basically, it's been duties, obligations to do things, and prohibitions against not doing things. You know, killing people, stealing from them, whatever. And it's also been looked at from an issue of character. What would a good person do under those circumstances? You know, a good person wouldn't go into a Safeway and steal food if they didn't need the food. You just wouldn't do that. And so one can look at it from a character point of view or from specific obligations or prohibitions. Okay. Where did the system or this theory of moral values come from? Experience as a human being, you know, to do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and that if you do that, maybe it works out well over a period of time, and gradually maybe that's the way human beings did things. Legal guidance, the laws have generally followed the ethical framework. We like to at least think that there's an ethical framework. Some people would say it's what's in the holy books, and it's been revealed to us. There seems to be some genetic characteristics that we carry, that certain animals carry, in terms of fairness. Chimpanzees seem to have a sense of fairness. A number of animals it may have certain ethical kinds of things. There's cultural, it may even be that we can do scientific studies to demonstrate that if you behave in a certain way, if you beat your children versus not beating your children, or use corporal punishment or not, that they're going to turn out differently. If you actually did that and did scientific research, and you might find out that certain behaviors and ethical behaviors can be determined on that fashion. Wherever it came from, ethics is not the same as what's legal. Torture is legal in some countries. It never is ethically. Slavery is still present someplace. It's not ethical. It's not ethically. So there is a distinction. I don't know if you can read this down here. These are two businessmen looking out at the factory. It says, "I've had lawyers all my life, so I never had to learn right from wrong." Well, that's one way of looking at things. Okay, it's a system, moral values, golden rule, the Ten Commandments. Historically, the system was most commonly applied to the in-group and not necessarily applied universally. So that there were ethical rules and regulations, how people did things as far as their in-group, but they had slaves. And those principles didn't apply to the slaves, or they didn't apply to the group that you were at war with, or that lived in across the river or something. They were treated entirely differently. Oaths and ancient codes of behavior, and that leads us in a medical world into the Hippocratic Oath that everybody's heard of. And I'm going to just spend a minute or two on the Hippocratic Oath, just so we know what it says and how it might or might not apply, and how it might or has influenced our medical ethics of today, because it has. Now, everybody know who Hippocrates was? He was a Greek physician. Back in the 300-400 BC, or BCE as it's now called, the physicians were traveling bands of physicians, and there were schools of physicians, and there was a Hippocratic group that wanted to separate itself from some of these other bands of physicians, and generally physicians were an unsavory group of people back in those days. I'd like to think that. You know, we can say the same about today's physicians, but let's not. And they traveled around, Hippocrates was a very charismatic kind of person, and he wanted to make his group stand out from the others, and they became a very close knit, and they did it by taking a very sacred oath, and this is the first couple paragraphs in it, and I just want to point out in the first paragraph the real key is I swear by Apollo, by Asclepius, by Hygieia, Panacea, and all the gods and goddesses. This was a very sacred oath. You could not have a more sacred oath than to be swearing your allegiance and to all the gods, and especially to the gods of medicine and health. The second paragraph, so they take it very seriously. Now, the second paragraph was, consider the teachers as dear to me as my parents, and the obligation to take care of the teachers of the art, the physicians that came before, and an obligation to teach the next generation. So there was a whole paragraph about teaching and about obligations to the teachers. That was another very important part of the Hippocratic Oath. And then there were several points here. I'll do things for the good of my patients and never do harm, right in the first paragraph there, just like the geologist pointed out, that do no harm. I will not give a deadly drug to anyone. I will not perform abortion. I will preserve the purity of my art, and I will not cut for stone. Cut for stone means I will not do surgery. Cutting for stone was for bladder stones. Individuals in those days, if they got bladder stones, were extremely painful, and there were practitioners that went around and opened the bladder to get that bladder stone out because of the severe pain. But you can imagine, no anesthesia, no antibiotics. Most of the patients died, serious complications. And so, as he says, he will leave this operation to those practitioners who do it. But the physicians, and for a long time, there was a separation between the barber surgeons up through the Renaissance, the barber surgeons versus the physicians. The physicians did not do surgery, and that was considered beneath them. And this is kind of interesting. In every house where I come, I will function only for the good of the patients, keeping myself away from seduction, from the pleasures of love with women or men, free or slave. So you're not going to seduce your patients or anybody else you find in the house. And down here, I will keep secret and not reveal what went on. Confidentiality, still an important part of medical ethics. And if I do this, I will be respected by all men and in all times, but if I swerve from this oath, may the reverse be my lot. Very sacred oath. So in summary, there were three do's and five don'ts. And the do's, prescribe for the good, keep confidentiality, and to teach. The do nots, do no harm, do not murder anyone, do not perform abortion, do not seduce one's patients, and do not do surgery. Well, that was 350 BCE. That's a long time ago. I mean, it's kind of hard to ask today's physicians, don't do surgery. The prescribing deadly drugs, certainly in Oregon and Washington, it is obviously legal. And so there are inconsistencies with the Hippocratic Oath in the way medicine is practiced. And that ought not be a surprise. But out of that, and over a long period of time, people have written volumes about medical ethics. What has happened is that we've come down to four basic ethical principles. And every physician knows these, or at least should know these, because this is what we base ethical judgments on. And underlying it all is an expectation by the public, because of we are professionals, of competence and service. So this competence and service is just a given. And then there are these four basic ethical principles. Non-maleficence, I don't talk that way usually. I say do no harm. Geologists always say that. Beneficence means to do good. And then there's autonomy, which is respect for the individual, and then justice. And we'll just run through those real quickly. Prescriptions about dealing with right and wrong and temptations, thou shalt not, all that, and obligations to do good are all kind of given. What we deal with when we mostly talk about medical ethics are the quandaries. What do we do with the lady that wants her pacemaker shut off? What do we do about harvesting stem cells, what do we do about death with dignity, where does euthanasia fit in? Those are all controversial, those are quandaries and dilemmas. All right, beneficence, it means to do good. And if you were here on Monday, you know we talked about evidence-based medicine. What we ought to be doing are things that are well-established that actually do good. There's a lot of things that are done in medicine that do not have the scientific evidence to prove that they're effective. So it should be evidence-based medicine. It should be good. That's a strong ethical principle. Second principle is to do no harm, or at least, if there is some harm to be done, that the benefits outweigh the risks. So that's that risk-benefit ratio. Example, somebody comes in with acute appendicitis, I have to, and I'm a surgeon, I have to hurt that patient in order to cure the appendicitis. I have to make a cut through the skin, run the risk of infection, other kinds of things. It can be painful. But the risks of not doing it outweigh the benefit, outweigh the risk of doing it in terms of what the benefits are going to be to the patient. That clear for that autonomy, a little more complicated. And in the past, I would say prior to 1950 even, autonomy didn't really play a big role in medical health. This was in terms of disclosure, in terms of keeping confidence, those things did. But as far as the patient preferences and the patient having to have full disclosure and knowledge about things, I mean, it was very common back in those days for the doctor not to tell the patient what was going on. And the families didn't tell. You know, don't tell mom she's got cancer because she'll lose all hope. And so it was kept secret, even though everybody in the family knew that the patient had cancer. That really changed, and changed dramatically, and almost was a complete flip in which patients' preferences became really the key. And it almost got to a point where physicians were going to say, well, you know, you got this disease, what do you want us to do? As if they could tell the physician what to do. But certainly if there is informed consent and full disclosure, and the patients have an opportunity to refuse therapy, and our case with AJ, with the pacemaker, she has the right to competently refuse to have treatment applied to her. So autonomy is a very important thing, and in this country it has assumed an extremely important role. And finally, there's justice, and we're talking about the equitable allocation of resources, and that there is a ethical principle that drives that. You can really raise the question whether we do it very well in this country, and we certainly don't want to be doing it at the bedside. We don't want to say, you know, we don't want Don to come in with some medical problem, and I say, you know, Don, there are some kids in the ghetto that aren't even getting their immunization, so I'm not gonna treat you. Well, that, you know, that would be, I mean, it would be true, but it certainly would not be doing that kind of rationing or limitation of services at the bedside. All right, so ethical dilemmas are not conflicts between good and evil, or right and wrong. I mean, there's no ethical conflict about when my patient is anesthetized that I go and rifle through their purse and steal their money. I'll let the insurance company do that. So it's not right and wrong, but the ethical dilemmas are conflicts between competing goods, patient choice versus doing harm, or doing good and distributed justice. So they're both good things, and then there's one more important than the other. Don said, do no harm. If just because it says first do no harm, does that really take precedence over everything else? Obviously, to remove the appendix, some harm has to be done. So there's an exception immediately, because one has to cut through the skin, go into the belly, to do whatever you're going to do. And there is harm, there's no question there's harm. Now, the net good outweighs that, but nonetheless there is harm. And it's not a great, when it's very clear that the good far outweighs the harm, then there's no ethical dilemma at all. But sometimes where the benefits are relatively small and the harm is potentially great, then it does become. So why what's the big deal about ethical dilemmas? And Hippocrates never talked about ethical dilemmas. They were all prescriptions, the do's and the don'ts. There was not, oh, we're gonna have a big discussion about. Well, the reasons were is that historically there weren't very many ethical dilemmas. Medicine couldn't do very much in terms of good or evil, and so the ethical dilemmas weren't there. But in the past 100 years, there's been a huge amount of change. Cultural changes, the increased emphasis on autonomy, diversity of the population, diversity of cultural backgrounds, religious fundamentalism has become much stronger, especially when tied in with autonomy, insurance and regulation, end-of-life care have become obviously big issues now. It used to be people died because we couldn't do anything. Now we can keep people alive for extended periods of time, and most people, the majority of people, probably it's close to 85 to 90% of people who die in intensive care units in the United States of America die because care is withdrawn. They don't die because we can't keep them alive any longer. They die because everyone's decided this does not make sense to continue down this road any longer. Kind of a real change. It's a change in my lifetime, huge change in my lifetime. From I started practicing Corvallis in the 1970s, doing pulmonary critical care. Right now, it's an entirely different picture in the intensive care unit. So end-of-life care, big issues, and we'll talk more about that. And technology has been a major factor in these ethical dilemmas. Okay, there we are. Heart, can we keep people alive indefinitely with artificial hearts? We probably can't. And then the whole thing with transplantation and growing new hearts, robotic surgery, whatever. The technology has just been absolutely phenomenal. Okay, those are the ethical principles. Do no harm, do good, autonomy, justice. And everything kind of works around those four principles. So, okay, so now we have a chance to come back and AJ hasn't left your office yet because she's waiting for an answer. And she's sitting there and she's reading Time magazine, she's reading about artificial hearts and stuff, and she said, I want none of that. I just want you to shut this damn thing off so that I can die and leave the world in peace. So now let's vote again. How many people want to turn off the pacemaker? Same three. Okay. Now we're seeing a few more hands go up. We're starting to think maybe autonomy is starting to, she has a right to make that decision, right? Yes.
Maybe I would say, I mean, not instantly, but talk with your family. Let's talk about this a little bit more first. Or saying, okay, done,
Yeah, go home and come back in a week. And
okay, let's really talk about this then.
Okay, so she comes back a week later and says, I talked to my daughter, and my daughter says, Mom, it's up to you, whatever you want to do.
Well, then there you go.
Okay. And does everybody, yes?
Wouldn't you also ask, why it is that she wants this?
Oh, that would be a good
thing. Very good question.
Good question. She says, study business.
No, but in the description you said that her daughter said that she has no depression. This question.
No, you're right on, and I'm being flipped. But is there anything else that anybody wants to know?
Depends what state you're in. What?
legal. No, it makes no difference. It makes no difference. Now, patients have a right to refuse therapy anywhere. Right. Supreme Court has determined that.
So once you have the pacemaker put in, it's up to you whether you want to keep it or not.
Yeah, and it's up to you.
The patient.
To you whether you wanted to put it in the first place.
I said, because it's an artificial.
Okay, so who wants to turn off the pacemaker? Again, are we changing all? So we're kind of split here. Okay. I'm going to show you a picture of a pacemaker. There's something funny about this pacemaker. Anybody want to make a comment about that pacemaker? This was removed from a patient?
It's got a bullet in it.
It's got a bullet in it. Yes, it does. There it is. 38 caliber bullet.
Wow.
This was somebody who... This is not my patient. this is a real pacemaker with a real bullet. Came out of a real person. Person wanted to have the doctor shut off the pacemaker. The doctor said, no, I can't do that. You'll die. They went home. They put a 38 caliber bullet, and the pacemaker stopped, but it was actually that caused a lot of bleeding, and the patient died, not instantaneously, but did die after shooting the bullet into the pacemaker. And so this is kind of a famous picture that is shown at all kinds of medical meetings. That's one approach. That's not the approach we recommend here. Okay. So let's turn off the... Who wants to shoot the patient?
Yes. My question is, I see the principle of autonomy dominating here, and if you have a totally with it patient who's, after you've examined everything, they want to shut off, how can you as a physician not do what they want? I mean, you're total. If you were to say, I will not shut off that pacemaker, you're totally violating their autonomy and their right to make a choice.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And the only reason is that most physicians do not like to have patients walk into the office and they're wheeled out. It doesn't look good. It doesn't feel good.
So there's got to be a back door.
All right, now look. Yes, I'm waiting for somebody to. Somebody has to come up with the right. With
legal ramifications.
Get me off the hook here.
They have to sign it.
Oh, even if they sign it, doesn't matter. I'm not worried about the legal part of this, really.
Oh.
Now there's something else. Nobody's asking the right question here. Go ahead.
You said that it could be turned off with some kind of an
electronic device.
Yeah. Could you tell the patients how to do it?
Oh, that's good. Let them do it themselves. Yeah, probably, but you know, she's 88, not particularly technologically savvy.
She doesn't need to learn
how to. How do you know you're ready to die?
Well, that's a good
choice. Does that matter?
No, but I want to know.
Okay, well, okay. What's the ethical dilemma here? Okay, one, it's already been stated. We've had two people here on opposite sides of the room. Somebody says, do no harm. Turning off the pacemaker may cause the patient severe harm or even death. Autonomy, the patient can make your own decisions about it.
Couldn't you argue from the do no harm perspective that if you don't turn it off, with the way we see age progress, she's going to come to more harm.
Maybe.
If we let something else take her.
But you don't know. We've all made an assumption here. What's the assumption we've made?
That she's going to die as soon as we turn it off.
Exactly. You think that's right? Do you know that?
No.
No, we don't know that. We don't know whether or not. I mean, we've all made assumptions. Pacemakers out there, we must be keeping her alive. Must have been put in by Dr. Hall, and he didn't put it in just to make money, of course. He put it in because she was probably going to die if she didn't have it in, or maybe she was just having symptoms. So in clinical medicine, the majority of ethical dilemmas result from incomplete information, misunderstandings, and miscommunication. They really do. It's just not a conflict of competing goods, although it could be. Okay, so how do we resolve? Be sure you have all the relevant clinical information. Make sure you know what's really going to happen if the pacemaker's turned off, so that you can make an informed decision and not just a decision like we all made. Be certain that everyone involved understands it. If it's still an issue there, address those competing values, discuss it in terms of autonomy and doing harm or doing good, and then attempt to reach an understanding so that everybody is on the same page and feels comfortable. So do we have all the relevant clinical information, and does everyone understand that information?
No.
We don't. So let's find out what we did. We turned the rate of the pacemaker down. We don't have to, it's not all or nothing. So the pacemaker's set at 80. She's very happy with that heart being 80. We start to turn it down. We turn it down to 60, to 40. We turn it down to 30. We turn it down to 20. And her heart kicks in at 30. Her own heart rate is 30. Well, 88-year-old people with a heart rate of 30 do not do well. I can guarantee you that. They're dizzy. They're lightheaded. But they don't die suddenly. She's short of breath, weak, lightheaded. She might be passing out. And we discuss that with her and say, you know, we can shut this pacemaker off. You're not going to die. You might die a few weeks from now or a few months from now, but you are going to be in hell for the next period of time, because you're going to be essentially bedridden, you're not going to be able to get up, you're not going to be able to enjoy life, you're not going to be able to get around, you're not even be able to come in to see me, which was like a big deal thing for her to come in and see her doctor. That was, and so once we discussed that, her desire to have this thing, she no longer had that choice of, well, I'm either going to be dead or not die. She lived 4 more years and died of a massive stroke unrelated to pacemaker. All right, so the majority of clinical ethical dilemmas can be resolved by better understanding of clinical data, good communication, all that kind of stuff. So the story here is that don't make certain assumptions without really knowing what's going on, because it is often more complicated, but it can be, the great dilemma could be solved. What we have here is a failure of communication. I don't know how many of you remember Cool Hand Luke, the movie? All right, it's not always so easy. What if she really had been pacemaker dependent and we turned it down and there was no intrinsic heart rate? Then we would have had to really deal with this. We would have to have some serious discussions with her, probably a psychiatric evaluation to make sure that there's not a clinical depression involved, exploring why she feels that way, and if everybody's involved, and one can convene every hospital in the state of Washington, state of Oregon has an ethics committee. And I'll say something about the ethics committee. We can convene that to get some additional kind of moral support for whatever decision. They're not going to decide, but they can give a recommendation. And I suspect that in most places now, this would have not been the case 10, 15, 20 years ago, but now, in 2011 and going forward, the decision would have been made that it's okay for her to have this thing turned off. Would you turn it off in the doctor's office, or would you turn it off? You could turn this off in her home, where she could be surrounded by friends, if she really wanted that. Sometimes people are just saying they want something done, and they something like this, and they want attention, they want love, they want there's some other thing that's driving it, and so that's the obligation of the care people to identify that. Okay, what are some of the bedside dilemmas that we do deal with? End of life decisions are big deal things. We're going to talk quite a bit about that. If somebody's incapacitated, who's going to make the decision? I trust that everybody in this room has filled out an advance directive and a power of health attorney, so they've named somebody to make that. Is there anybody that hasn't done that? Oh, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're young or old. And in fact, the great controversial cases were Karen Ann Quinlan, were Nancy Kruzan, and most recently Terry Schiavo. Everybody knows about these cases. They were all young women who had brain damage, and they became, you know, somebody like me. I get brain damage. Number one, you can't tell. Number two, number two is that.
Oh, you'd start making sense.
All right, you the geologist has spoken again. Great wisdom. Number two is that, you know, for old folks, there's not really as much controversy about whether we keep them hooked up or not hooked up or whatever, but when it's a young person, it becomes much more controversial. Patients and families have unrealistic expectations. We've talked about unrealistic expectations in medicine. They certainly have unrealistic expectations about being cured of something where there's been severe brain damage or something of that sort. Conflicts between family members, between families and providers, between providers. Boy, that is an issue. We have our surgeons, our cardiac surgeons. Somebody has a serious complication post-op. They want everything done, and the family doesn't sure they want it. The nurses clearly think that it's futile, and so those are real ethical dilemmas. The whole question about informed consent, organ donation, mental illness. You know, can we hold people because they're acting crazy, or we think they might be a danger? Informed consent and full disclosure is a major issue. I mentioned earlier how many patients have been on chemotherapy and have come back and said, "If I'd only really known how bad it was going to be, I never would have done it." Or I'll give you an example. Dawn. Decide it needs to have a major operation. And he talks to me, I'm his surgeon. He talks to me a week before the surgery, and I say, yeah, we're going to do it Tuesday morning. We're going to do it Monday morning. At 7:30, you be there at 6:30, and they'll get you ready, take you into surgery. And I will be doing the surgery at 7:30. Doing 7:30 and 8, the anesthesiologist will be there. We'll be in operation for about 3 hours, after which you'll be in recovery for about an hour, and then you're going to be up on the ward. He says, Dr. Fine, I really feel good about this. What I didn't tell him is that I'm going to be on call that weekend at the hospital. Now, a typical surgeon's call is they start Friday night, they work all day Saturday night, all day Sunday night, and sometime on Monday they get off. Turns out that it was a bad weekend in Corvallis, big automobile accident, the football game, a bunch of, the guys got into it, a couple ducks got with a couple beavers and somebody got stabbed. And I was up all night, all Saturday night, all Sunday night, operating. Two people came in with appendicitis. Monday morning, I'm beat, I'm tired. But Dawn is there to have surgery, and we just wheel them in, and I just go ahead and do surgery. I am an impaired physician. I don't think I am, because I'm macho. This is happening all over the country. This is not unique. Should I tell Dawn, look, Dawn, I've been up all night, maybe we ought to cancel this. Or maybe we ought to get Dr. Smith over here to do the surgery because he wasn't on call all weekend, but we won't be able to do it till later in the afternoon. That's going to screw up the operating room schedule. Let's just go ahead and do it. And that's the way it's done. And that's the way the American system, by and large, works. Is that fully informed consent and full disclosure? I would say no, it's not. And it's something that we haven't really dealt with in medical profession. So, be that sort of, so you're in the situation, find out if your surgeon's going to be on call the night before. It's not unreasonable to ask that. And if that's the case, get it scheduled on a day when you know the surgeon is not going to be on call the night before. End of life decisions is what this whole talk was advertised to be. And so let's deal with them kind of quickly. Things my patients never said to me at the end of life. Gee, Dr. Hall, I wish I had spent more time at work. I've never had anybody say that to me. They always have said, gee, I wish I had spent more time with my family, with my friends, with my hobbies, traveling, doing whatever. Another thing I've never heard anybody say, hey, doc, keep me alive as long as possible because I think I'm going to hell. I've never met anybody who thought they were going to go to hell. Everybody either thinks they're... there is no afterlife, or that they are going to go to heaven. It doesn't matter what their life is, and that's a good thing, because otherwise they would be under great emotional stress, and I don't want to take care of people that have that additional burden. But there are people that have a lot of guilt. They may not feel they're going to hell, but there are things that they have not resolved that are difficult for them. Bill Moyers, back in 2005, at a big television program about end-of-life issues called Our Own Way, said there were five things that people should say if they have the time at the end of life. And these were the five things would to their loved ones and to the people that are important to them, to say, thank you, forgive me, I love you, I forgive you, and goodbye. And that's something that I hope we all, that all of us have time to say that. Sudden death takes away that chance to do that, and so that's sort of a message to all of us to make sure that we're saying that frequently to the people that are important to us, and that we not necessarily wait until we're on our deathbeds. Okay, a little bit just in terms of terms, this is levels of consciousness. We can be fully awake, like most of us are. There's a few of you dozing off out there, but that's okay. I won't point at you. No, we're not gonna... sleep. When somebody's asleep, from a distance, they look like they're dead. But they're not, so you don't want to run over and start pounding on their chest and doing things to resuscitate them. They wake up and tell you, what's going on. So sleep is just a transient state of unresponsiveness, but they can be they can respond to stimuli, and they do. Obtundation of people, when you do shake them and wake them up, they're just sort of confused, don't know where they are. It's just they can't become fully alert. They may be alert enough to say yes, no, it hurts, follow some simple commands. Coma, you can't wake them up. You just can't wake. It doesn't matter what you do, they are unresponsive to you. So they can't follow commands, they can't talk. Coma is reversible, or potentially reversible. Anybody that's in a coma, for whatever reason, they got hit on the head, they've been given an anesthetic, they drank too much, whatever, if they're unresponsive, but it's reversible. And so somebody can stay in coma for a period of time. You can do brainwave tests, and people have been in a state of coma for weeks and months. If you're in, and then you always hear the story about somebody was in a coma for 27 years, and then they wake up, and then they go out and play golf the next day, they remember everybody. That's the stuff you see in the tabloids. It's not true, because if you've been in a coma for a prolonged period of time, there are all kinds of other physical changes that take place, and nobody wakes up. They may become kind of somewhere in an obtunded thing, even after weeks and months, probably not after multiple years. A persistent vegetative state is what Terry Schiavo was in. You don't wake up from that. But you have a level of activity. You're breathing on your own. You probably can't swallow on your own, but you can digest food. Your basic lower brain, the reptilian brain functions are working, but the higher brain functions are not. Terry Schiavo had essentially no cortical brain left whatsoever. The MRI scan showed that, the perfusion scan showed there was no functioning, higher functions of the brain whatsoever. There was no way she could ever wake up because that brain tissue had been long since gone. That's persistent vegetative state. Nobody wakes up from that. So if you're in that and you have the laboratory evidence, you and I can't really tell the difference, but just looking at somebody, where they are in this. So you have a historical, what's happened to them over time, and you have some laboratory tests, brainwave tests, perfusion tests to determine they are. Nobody wakes up from this. Brain death is, the heart may still be going, they have to be on life support, but there's no brain activity whatsoever, not even the reptilian brain functions are gone. And that is legal death in every state in the United States. So if you have no brain function whatsoever, you are dead. You are legally dead. Your heart can still be beating, you can still be hooked up to a machine to breathe for you, but you are dead. So, okay, we understand those terms? Okay, capacity. You have to, in order to have capacity to make decisions, this is a medical decision, you have to have capacity, you have to be alert, you have to understand, you have to be able to refuse treatment. So you have to have, if you're in persistent vegetative state, or if you're obtunded, or if you're in coma, you cannot have capacity. Also, if you have Alzheimer's disease, or if you have severe mental illness, you may not have capacity. And so that's a judgment that professionals make. Does this person understand, and can they judge? If they don't have capacity, somebody has to substitute judgment for that person. And it's called substituted judgment. The Supreme Court says that's perfectly okay, that we can have something, and that's logical, but it took a Supreme Court action to really say that someone else could make decisions. Who is going to make those decisions? You can determine that in your advanced directive. You can also give some guidelines as to what you would want, and you can name a healthcare representative, which is a power of attorney for healthcare. All of us should have named somebody who we trust, that knows us well enough, that knows our values, that knows what's important in our life. So I would encourage everyone to do that. In the absence of that, there are state statutes. State of Washington, State of Oregon are exactly the same as far as who, if we have not named the healthcare representative, this is the order in which the state will say there's legal authority to make decisions for you. So if you have a spouse, if you're married to someone, never get divorced, but you're separated by 1,000 miles and 1,000 orders of magnitude about how you view the world, that spouse still has legal responsibility to make a decision for you. So be aware of that. If it's not, if you don't have a spouse, or the spouse is unable, unwilling, or equally incapacitated because of a motor vehicle accident that hurt both of you, then it's going to be your parent, if you have a living parent. You may or may not want your parent to be making that decision. Or adult children, or adult sibling, it's in that order, or any adult relative, if we have no adult siblings, or an adult friend. And if we have none of those, one of two things will happen. Either your attending physicians, usually in consultation with the ethics committee, will make decisions under those circumstances. Or if there's a lot of controversy, it's not, and it's a very difficult thing, the state of Washington or the state of Oregon or Minnesota or wherever can be asked to name a guardian. So you would have a guardian name. Yes?
If you have a legal separation but not a legal divorce, does that still apply? Is that an area in there?
Boy, you know, you would be best off, or if anyone would be best off under any circumstance, but especially in a circumstance where there was any legal question that somebody could come in and make a decision that you, and you really don't want that person to make a decision, that you then name a healthcare representative. A healthcare representative takes precedence over spouse.
Okay.
So if there's ever going to be any question, I don't know what the legal, you know, what a legal separation means, you know, in Minnesota or in Oregon or Washington, for that matter.
In the Schiavo case, what was the issue there?
The issue, Terry Schiavo, she had a spouse, and she had a parent, or a couple of parents, and the spouse and the parents didn't agree, and there was no healthcare representative, and there were no advance directives. The spouse said she never wanted to be kept alive like this. The parents said, who happened to be Catholic, the parents said, oh, she definitely wanted to be kept alive. And they just got into a court fight over this, even though legally the spouse could make the decision. It went 9 times to various courts in Florida, including the Florida Supreme Court, and it went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in every case, they said the spouse had the right to make the decision, and things were withdrawn, and she died. And then when they looked, I mean, we had the Senate minority leader at the time, who was a physician, stating publicly that she was responsive and waking up and all this other kind of stuff. I mean, from what he saw, it was bizarre what went on, the politics that got mixed up at the bedside. The system worked. I mean, unfortunately, I had to go through it, but the right decision was finally made in the Terry Schiavo case. Just a couple other things. Areas of controversy, where do we get into trouble? Cardiopulmonary resuscitation, that's where your heart stops beating completely. You would die within a couple minutes if someone doesn't stop pounding on your chest and put electric shocks across your chest. That's cardiopulmonary resuscitation. The big thing about cardiopulmonary resuscitation is that, in contrast to Don's impression from watching television doctor programs where 70 or 80% of the people wake up and do fine after that electric shock is put on, you know, the whole day, all jump off the bed, and you've all seen this, and they do great. In real life, in the hospital, if you have a cardiac arrest in the hospital, you have less than a 15% chance that you are going to leave the hospital alive. 15%, 1/5, less than that. And if you do leave the hospital alive, you have about a 50% chance you are going to go to a nursing home with brain damage. So cardiopulmonary resuscitation, even in a hospital, is not good. If it's out on the street, it's even worse. In the streets of Seattle, which has the best records in the country because they have this, they've trained everybody, bystanders, CPR, anybody from Seattle knows about that, and the quick response teams and all this kind of stuff out there, it's about a 6 or 7% survival out of hospital, if it's out of hospital arrest, that they make it through, you know, they take them to the hospital and then survive. So it's not what it's cracked up to be.
Are those odds the same for out of hospital? Because, I mean, you now see 80
well, it, you know, it's, you know, it, when you get down to individuals, you can prognosticate and say, well, this person's going to have a high risk. So somebody like you that happened to be out jogging and you're running a marathon or something, and you know you're not going to have it, but it's say a 45-year-old guy that's out there running, and just as he goes by the fire department, the EMTs already are out there with the ambulance because they're watching the marathon goes by, he drops and they can come running out there and start resuscitating him immediately, where he's a young, healthy, otherwise vigorous person, then he's going to have a much better chance of having a good recovery.
Okay.
If it's not witnessed, and that's what most out-of-hospital arrests are, you walk down the street, all of a sudden you see somebody lying there. You know, like you're not sure what happened or how they got there, and you go over to them, they're not breathing, and you pound on the chest, you send somebody to call 911. That's not going to be, in the overwhelming majority, that's not going to do well. Starting, stopping, withholding, withdrawing life support is a big issue, as you can imagine, in the hospital. It is always easier to start it than it is to stop it. It is always easier not to start it than it is to stop it. Same reason for AJ stopping her pacemaker, not putting it in the first place would have been okay. I mean, we would have said, gee, you're going to really suffer if we don't put it in. Or we don't even have time, but if she says, don't resuscitate me, if she's a don't resuscitate and her heart stops beating, we never would put the pacemaker in the first place. And there's no difference ethically between not putting it in or taking it out after you did put it in. Ethically, it's the same thing. In terms of emotions, just for the reason we had our discussion here, it's a different thing. And even though ethically you say, feeding tubes, big deal thing, feeding tubes don't prolong anybody's life. And they don't stop people from aspirating. It makes other people feel good that we're taking care of them. There are certain conditions that people have certain surgeries and things like this, but if somebody is at a stage in their life where they can't eat because they have metastatic cancer, putting a feeding tube is not going to help them. Futile care, where there's a low probability of success, it almost never is zero, because somebody, it could always be one in a million, one in a billion chance that somebody's going to recover. So, you know, and you hear a family say, well, it's one in a, doctor, you say it's one in a million chance this patient's going to recover. Well, we'll take it. Well, what does that mean? You know, it's not going to happen. And then the transition from regular care to comfort care is where we change the approach. No longer are we concentrating on the disease, but we're concentrating on the patient, trying to make sure that we maximize comfort, allow them to pass on into the next world. All right, so when it comes to terminal care, relief of symptoms, that's palliative care. Terminal sedation, has everybody heard that term? Anybody heard that term? So terminal sedation, somebody is usually end stage some kind of disease, either profound congestive heart failure, frequently cancer, and they may be enrolled in hospice, so they still may be in the hospital. And the idea is we are going to concentrate so much on symptoms that we're going to put somebody on an intravenous medications of some kind, usually morphine, and that is going to sedate them for comfort. It's also going to shorten their lives. So you have this dual effect. You have the effect of relief of symptoms, and it's to the point where the patient is not really alert or conscious any longer. Self-starvation is something that people have a choice for. It's not exactly suicide. It's just choosing not to eat when they get to a point where they don't really feel like eating, and they can decide not to eat any longer but continue to take liquids, and their demise will follow over a period of a week or two or several. And it sounds like it would be awful. It turns out that it's not. It's an option that patients have. Physician aid in dying, or what's been called physician-assisted suicide, Oregon and Washington are the two states that allow that. There's a lot of rules and regulations and hoops to jump through. It does not apply to some of the patients who would need it the most. Someone with severe Alzheimer's disease doesn't know who they are or where they are. They're not capable of actually jumping through those hoops. So they will remain alive for a much longer period of time than someone, say, that has cancer, has a six-month prognosis, and says, you know, I want to take this into my own hands. Euthanasia is not legal in any state. It is practiced widely in a single province in Australia and in the Netherlands. And somewhat surreptitiously, or maybe not surreptitiously any longer, in Switzerland. But it's not legal in any state of the United States. That's where a physician actually would make a same thing you would do with your dog. or your cat at the end of life. You're saying this cat, this dog is suffering, it's lived a good life, it's had a wonderful life, and I don't want to see it suffer any longer. We'll give it a single shot and kill it. That's euthanasia, and if with humans, you can't do that. And in fact, these two become the same legally in the United States. Yes?
So what's the difference between physician aid in dying and euthanasia?
Physician aid in dying, the patient, the physician, first of all, there's a bunch of hoops to jump through, make sure the patient's not depressed, make sure the patient does meet criteria of having a terminal illness that we expect them to die within 6 months. And confirmed by two separate physicians. Then a physician can write a prescription for a lethal dose of a medicine that the patient can take themselves. They have to ask for it twice. They have it once in writing, once orally, and then they can have that prescription. They can go to the pharmacy, get that prescription filled, and then at their own leisure, under their own volition, and whenever they choose, can then take that the dose of that medicine. And they most, you know, 99% are going to be dead within 30 minutes after they take it. You can have as many friends around, relatives around, or you can do it by yourself. You could ask your physician to be there. The physician aid in dying is really documenting the disease, making sure that all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted, and that the prescriptions are written and appropriately filled, and the patient's instructed on how to do that. That can be done. I'm not sure about the Washington experience. You've only had it, I think, for about a year now. Oregon's had it for 10 years. And in Oregon, approximately 1 out of every 1,000 deaths is a physician aid in dying. So it's not being used in a huge number. So 1 out of 1,000. I'm sorry?
1 in 1,000?
1 in 1,000. So it's roughly 80, somewhere between 60 and 80 people per year. More than that, actually get the prescriptions. Many, many people are very happy that it's available. They feel a sense of comfort. They know that if things got really bad, they could use it, but they don't use it. And that's why it passed. I don't know if you know the history in Oregon. It was a referendum. It passed 51 to 49%. The Catholic Church was outraged. Some right-wing people were outraged. They went to the Oregon legislature and said, we can't let this thing go through. The Oregon legislature didn't know what to do. So they said, well, we're going to send the same thing back to the people and have them vote again. So it was voted a second time, 2 years later, at the election cycle, and it passed 60-40, despite a huge advertising effort on the part of the Catholic Church to defeat it. And it was sort of like, you didn't listen to us the first time, and it was just sort of such an insult, so that even people who may not have really felt strongly about it before one way or another just said, this is, it was a real slap at the people of Oregon. Okay.
And so then euthanasia would just be the doctor making
the decision? Yes, I didn't finish that. So a doctor, this would be a patient unable to do this themselves. So the doctor either the doctor makes a decision, or the physician, the patient could ask for it. Doctor, give me a shot and kill me. The doctor could ask for that. That is illegal in the state of Oregon. And illegal in every state. Okay, so there's an ethics committee. Every hospital has an ethics committee. Every hospital in Washington, Oregon, I'm sure in Minnesota. And the ethics committee is multidisciplinary. It has community representation. Has diversity, and we do ethics consultations, we educate the medical staff, and review policies. Again, principles, you hammer away at that. All right, if you want to leave and get out of here, you may right now. The other thing I have, and I'm going to share this with anybody who wants to stay, is ethics on a bigger scale. The politics, this will take about less than 5 minutes. Societal, political, bioethical dilemmas. It's Cliff Hall's top 10 bioethical dilemmas that we're going to be facing as a society. And I'm just going to throw these out at you with a lot of discussion, but just to kind of raise an interest. Okay, number one, the licensed providers, that means doctors, pharmacists, nurses, have the right to opt out of providing needed medical care or medication. We are facing that all the time. Typical thing is the morning after the pill. the availability of abortion. Legal services that somebody has strong moral objection to. If you're licensed by the state and it's a legal service, do you have the, should you have the option not to make that available to the patient? We're going to have to resolve that because it's a real big issue. It's an issue in a hospital. Right in my hospital, if a nurse doesn't want to be involved in some procedure or do something, they don't have to be. There's enough other people that are willing to. In small rural community hospitals, that's not the case. And suddenly services don't become available, or you have poorly trained people in there assisting on procedures that that have a potential risk, that and you don't have the best people there to do it. This is a real issue, I think.
Do pharmacists fall under that?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
In fact, that's a real problem in some rural communities where a pharmacist. I mean, there are communities across the United States where you can't get birth control pills, even though they're perfectly legal and perfectly reasonable. They don't cause abortion or anything. But if the pharmacist says, "I think birth control is evil," or wrong, or if I prescribe it, I may go to hell, then they won't do it. So somebody may have to drive 40, 50, 60 miles to another community to find those services. If it's a morning after pill, then it becomes even, then the time issue becomes of great importance. All right, under what circumstances is physician-assisted suicide, physician aid in dying appropriate? We kind of discussed that a little bit. And is euthanasia ever ethical? And we're going to have to deal with that, because if you have bad Alzheimer's disease and you have written down, I've told my wife, if I ever get to the point where I don't know who I am or where I am, figure out some way to put me out of my, whether I'm in misery, whether you think I'm in misery or not, figure out some way so that I don't end up just being in a...
I'm not going to jail.
You know, at least said it's murder down there, you know, but I mean, you know, so I'm laying this guilt trip on her in advance, but you know, I mean, we got to deal with that. We just can't keep putting our heads in the sand. I mean, we treat our animals better than we treat our loved ones. You know, it doesn't make sense. Okay, here it is. Before we try assisted suicide, Mrs. Rose, let's give the aspirin a chance. He looks remarkably like Hitler, so I hadn't thought about that before, but we'll get out that one though. Okay. What limitations should be placed on a woman's right to choose to have an abortion? You know, this is going to be a continuing thing. We're going to have to deal with that in this country in some meaningful kind of way. We can't continue on just having it come up to every Supreme Court nominee, we got to come to some resolution about whatever restrictions we're going to have. We just have to agree as a society. Should age ever be used as a criterion for rationing of care? Now, most of us can say, well, you know, I don't really think it's a good idea, but if you're 100 years old, 110 years old, 160 or 7 years old, can we put some limits on that? Can we say at some point, you know, comfort care is appropriate, and we're not really going to do bypass surgery? We're not going to give chemotherapy to the 96-year-old, knowing that, you know, and you know, it's.
I'll give up Viagra.
Well, there'll be a lot of people who will be happy if you do. Here's this one to follow up on that. Well, you're going home tomorrow. This poor guy. He's. I don't know. All right. He's just repeating this question again. All right. Is cloning of humans ethical? Is sex obsolete? Essentially, I guess if we get rid of Viagra, then it may not be obsolete, but it may be dysfunctional. So is cloning. So here's something. This is December 10th, 2010. Mice are created from two males. I mean, you know, and they're living mice. They're really doing pretty well. So they also create them from two, you know, from two females or from a single female. We can do that. It can be done in humans. There's no question. Hasn't been done yet. It's going to be done. Somebody's going to do it. Probably in Italy or someplace first, or South Korea or China or somewhere, but it's going to be done. And it's a clone person is a person. I mean, we can't say, well, they're going to be a slave, or they're going to be a separate class, or you treat them like a chimpanzee or a pet or something. They're going to be people, just like anybody else. And so what does it mean to be cloned? It's going to happen. We're going to deal with it. Number five, should there be limits on the use of performance-enhancing drugs? We had a discussion at the table this morning. We're talking about performance-enhancing drugs. There's lots of performance-enhancing drugs. And, you know, fortunately, he stopped the steroids last year, and he's going to stop Viagra tonight.
When I'm 106.
I see. And there are drugs. There's a drug called Provigil. Anybody heard of Provigil? It's a drug that improves mental function and raises your IQ score, believe it or not. It also keeps you awake. The military uses it in their elite units and in their pilots that fly from Nebraska to Iraq and drop a bomb and then fly back to, you know, where there's two pilots in a plane and they have to go that whole distance and it's like 30 hours of flying or whatever. And this medicine helps them stay awake, to stay alert. So it's a performance-enhancing drug, mental performance. So what if we have variants of that allow kids to learn faster, do better, do a whole lot better on exams, and people can afford it. One set of parents can afford that drug, another set of parents, and one kid is going to get the scholarship into college, the other isn't. And it's, so not only is it in athletics, where you hear about it, and it's in the bedrooms, and it's going to be on the IQ tests and performance tests in school and college and all that other kind of stuff. And it's being used in college right now. Kids are getting a hold of it, and they're doing better on their exams because they remember better, they can study better. Should it be banned? How do we deal with that? Should organ donation be an opt-out or an opt-in? Right now, it's an opt-in. You go for your driver's license in Washington or Oregon, you say, I want to be a donor, I don't want to be a donor. You don't have to be a donor. And so if you don't say anything, you're not a donor, you have to actually say, I want to be a donor, check the box. Colorado had an initiative that was going to be on the ballot that was going to change that, and that if you didn't write anything, you were a donor. You have to opt out of the program because there's a shortage of organs. And so some 18-year-old kid on a motorcycle bangs his head into a tree and, you know, brain dead, and has a good heart and two good kidneys and a good lungs and good liver. And if he didn't check off that box, that's just wasted. That just gets buried, and other people don't get the benefit of that. And so that was taken off because of the, I'm not sure who the people were that objected strenuously, but it was basically on a political decision to, so it never got voted on. But this is something that's going to come up. It's going to come up, I think, eventually in every state. We'll have to deal with it in one way or another. How is he feeling? I badly need a pair of kidneys. All right. Number three, under what circumstances should individuals with mental illness be forced to accept medical treatment? This is a real big issue. Can we force people? We have people in jail or in mental hospitals who committed crimes because they're schizophrenic or whatever, and they're being given medicine so they can get well enough so they can be prosecuted and executed. I mean, it makes just horrible situation when you think about it. And we have all kinds of people who don't want to be treated, who may or may not be a risk to themselves or whatever, and they don't want to take those mind-altering medications, and it's understandable why they don't feel good, they can wait, a lot of side effects, but can we force people to do that? Number two, what's the relationship of humans to other animals and to the earth? Big, big deal, ethical thing. Do we have dominion over all creatures, large and small, or are we fellow creatures, fellow travelers here on this planet Earth? And what's our responsibility? And what's our responsibility to the Earth? And how does that fit into an ethical thing of justice and doing no harm and doing what's good for all mankind and not necessarily just what's good for ourselves? Number one, are there areas of medical research which should be restricted or prohibited? And we kind of hit on that a little bit earlier when we talked about 2045, that's how many years from now? 34 years from now? The year man becomes immortal. We kind of joked a little bit about it. We talked about it. There are some things 35 years from now, the way biomedicine and technology is moving, that may not be so far-fetched. That may not be so far-fetched. And we better start thinking about it. Who's going to become, you know, who gets it? You know, the Cliff Hall's novel that I've never written, you know, was that this get, you know, somebody's working on the fish, you know, the salmon. We all know the salmon out here in the Pacific Northwest. They come up, they spawn. They beautiful, strong fish, and within 30 days, they're shriveled up and dead and dying and rotting away. And I mean, clearly, that's a genetically programmed thing. I mean, we talk about programmed senescence and death. What if we can reverse that in humans? What does that mean? Wow. Anyway, the elephant in the room when we talk about all these things is access to basic medical care, a right, a societal responsibility, or a commercial commodity. Right now, we think it's this country thinks it's this, and we fight over that. And that's what we do. So take home messages, a couple. Try to remember these when there seems to be some question. From the perspective at the bedside, clinician taking care of patients, we can approach them systematically, and they usually can be resolved with good communication, everybody understanding what's going on. From a societal point of view, all those, you know, the top 10 we just talked about, the debate will be much more civil and productive if we frame those issues in the context of the competing ethical principles. So almost every one of them, we can talk about it in terms of justice, in terms of autonomy, in terms of doing good and doing harm, and how we balance those things and where we put our emphasis. And if we talk about it that way, it's not like you're wrong, I'm right. You know, this kind of anger that comes out when we talk, whether we're talking about abortion or whether we're talking about organ transplantation or anything else, we can say, okay, well, why are you stating this? Because you feel autonomy, or you feel doing harm. So if you discuss it from those point of views, you can see that everybody's got good points to make, and then one has to reach meaningful compromise. This is my final message, and we've gone a little over an hour. Complete your advanced directives and power of attorney for health care. Do that. Do that. Everybody needs to do that. And thank you.